Blog Talk Radio.
To Masonic Effects, where you can linger and at your leisure and join in with topics of interest to Masons. We're speaking to the world today at the 309th day of the year. Some reflections, eh? Time for reflection this time of year, particularly because we're, I think, coming up to a recognition of something that I find very hard to understand, the armistice. And I can't begin to share with you the poignancy and meaning of that moment to each one of you, because it will be different. I couldn't possibly do it, and it would be heartless of me to forget. So what I'll share with you today is what happens here. What happens in this part of the world. I'm so blessed and fortunate to be in Canada, and to listeners out there who may not know, I was born on an island province here in this country, and I am the progeny of hundreds of years of farmers and fishermen, blacksmiths, since the landing of the first Graham in our lineage from Scotland in 1798. So we tend to be consistent. We tend to have a strong sense of loyalty, morality, work ethic. That's the war. Some of you may or may not know, is fought in many levels besides what goes on in the battleground, the killing fields, as it's become known, the production of armaments is concerted. It's strategic. It's purposeful, it's necessary. The effect on the civilian population is without exception, without exception. So when I hear the term World War, it clearly and obviously was profound. The part that my family played came out of some research that was done that pulled this together by some archaeologists and historians in Britain, feeding people, troops and civilian populations need to eat, because if we don't eat, we starve. We can go quite more time without food than we can without water, of course, but this is the first time that government control of farm production was recognized as a necessity, and every square inch of land was put into the production of food, and particularly in North America, that was outside of the European and South Pacific basins of operations. This was an area that brought supplies to the world. And while we did have some soldiers in the family, First and Second World War, there was a clear message for farmers not to enlist, because if all the farmers enlisted and went to war, which was the tendency, as you can imagine, there wouldn't be anybody left behind knowing how to produce. And we needed the best. We collectively, the world needed the very best to get the maximum amount of crop rotation and production, and to be able to implement new techniques, the so-called at the time scientific techniques. So as much as it was against the sort of the moral fiber of a lot of men, this wasn't an act of resistance as much as an act of sacrifice. You made your effort by providing the flour and the meat and the food that was necessary. Without that, the army, as they say, the armies march on their stomach. I can't remember how far back the generals were talking about that. And so at the end of when the armistice was signed, the guns were silenced, the war effort for farmers around the world did not stop, because there was a massive migration of men coming back, men and women, coming back from the Navy and Air Force and Army. And they were immediately unemployed, and so they needed to be fed. Rationing was necessary, but you didn't ration thin air. You had to have a commodity. And so the war, in that sense, went on for another 5 years for farmers. And went on largely, that sacrifice, that call to duty, was largely ignored, still is, except for families like mine that were well aware and feeling compelled. There was not a question. An acknowledgement probably would have been thoughtful for a nation, but so you have it, eh? Remember, I'm going to talk to you about a time. I think today I'm feeling compelled to think in terms of nostalgia. It's referred to. The definitions are very interesting. I think at times Masons are nostalgic. A wistful desire to return in thought or in fact to a former time in one's life, to one's land or homeland, or to one's family and friends, a sentimental yearning for the happiness of a former place or time. It's like experiencing a sentimental or wishful yearning for the happiness felt in a former place or time or situation. And it's maybe better for some of us to understand it as a feeling of pleasure and also a slight sadness when you think about things that happened. So it's not quite the state of being homesick or, you know, an excessive sentimentality, but it's part of that. And it's typical. A place where we associate with personal happiness. Anyway, why is that important? None of that's important in the big scheme of things, you'd say, but it's critical to the way we function as human beings. Not so very long ago, Armistice Day and Thanksgiving were linked and held every year on the Monday before November 11th. And Thanksgiving was celebrated with special dinners at home and sports and, you know, outdoor activities. And these normally passed quietly and went unnoticed by the press. But in contrast, even though it was not official holiday, November 11th saw large and serious-minded gatherings at local cenotaphs and also in Parliament Hill in Ottawa. That's our nation's capital, which usually received intense press coverage. Here's a little bit of history that you may not know. But this was an unpopular anomaly. The Armistice Day was celebrated informally, and Remembrance Day. At its founding convention in Winnipeg on November 1925, the Canadian Legion passed a resolution affirming that Armistice Day should be held only on November 11th and led a campaign to have this enacted by Parliament. So on the 18th of March 1931, A.W. Neil, he was an MP for Comox, Alberni, in British Columbia, introduced a motion in the House of Commons to have Armistice Day observed on November 11th and no other date. But there were concerns about the holiday's impact on business, and he claimed that those claims were irrelevant. And at the same time, another MP, C.W. Dickey of Nanaimo, also speaking on behalf of veterans, moved an amendment changing the name of Armistice to Remembrance Day. And this term, he felt, better implies that we wish to remember and perpetuate. Historian Denise Thompson has suggested the term Remembrance Day placed the emphasis squarely upon memory and by extension upon the soldiers whose deaths were being remembered, rather than upon the armistice, a political achievement in which rank and file soldiers were not directly involved. Parliament quickly adopted these resolutions, and Canada held its first Remembrance Day on the 11th November, 1931. And since then, Remembrance Day has remained the official title for the annual commemoration, although the term Armistice Day is sometimes used interchangeably but unofficially. Remembrance Day is more flexible and inclusive and readily accommodates remembrance of war dead from the Second World War, the Korean War, and other conflicts and peacekeeping. Every year, ceremonies are held at cenotaphs in cities and towns around the country, involving prayer and recitations and playing the traditional military bugle calls of last post, followed by reveille. But the largest carried live by the nation's television networks here is at the National War Memorial in Ottawa, and attended by the Prime Minister, the Governor General, and the Silver Cross Mother, a mother who has actually lost a child or children in action. It's a time that our nation remembers and salutes. Now, I know you'll remember in your own special way, with those private thoughts that go with this kind of date, this time of contemplation. So I'm not going to necessarily repeat that, but I hope that some of you will sort of figure the message here. This is about a disaster that happened on the 10th of November, 1975. And this is a song that was put out by one of our more famous songwriters, Gordon Lightfoot. For me, it brings an eeriness and an importance and a reflection. And also, I have this feeling of the power, regardless of what white arms we might create or the terror we might instill in ourselves and the enemy. There's higher power, greater power. It's a fact. None of these mariners wanted to go down in that night. It was a terrible storm. Anyway, this is a way that Masonic Effects will reflect on Remembrance Day, the 10th. Formerly the Armistice Day.
The legend lives on from the Chippewa on down of the big lake they call Kitchigumi. The lake, it is said, never gives up her dead when the sky as a November turned gloomy. With a load of iron ore, 26,000 tons more than the Edmund Fitzgerald weighed empty. That good ship and true was a bone to be chewed when the gales of November came early. The ship was the pride of the American side, coming back from some mill in Wisconsin. As the big traders go, it was bigger than most, with a crew and good captain well seasoned. Concluding some terms with a couple of steel firms when they left fully loaded for Cleveland. Then later that night when the ship bell rang, could it be the north wind they'd been feeling? The wind and the wires made a paddle steel sound. Every man knew as the captain did too, with the witch of November come stealing. The dawn came late and the breakfast had to wait when the gales of November came flashing. When afternoon came, it was freezing rain in the face of a hurricane west wind. Thank you. In a musty old hall in Detroit, they prayed in the Maritime Sailors' Cathedral. The church bell chimes, it would ring 29 times for each man on the Edmund Fitzgerald. The legend lives on from the Chippewa down of the big lake they call Kitchigumi. Superior, they said, never gets up to dead when the gales of November come early.
Sort of a, there you have it. Maybe it connects us, the nations and continents all connected by some shore. We met shore to shore through our sailors and shared ideas and science and philosophy and religions through the captains and crew. Not so very long ago in the history of the world. Just a moment of contemplation for some. Maybe it'll resonate for others. Sad. Just remarkably sad. But that's part of this season where we can collectively join together culture to culture. Eventually, the conflict passes. The memories, we hope, are joined with, not necessarily with forgiveness, not necessarily, but we shouldn't ever forget that collectively we're capable of that kind of madness, and that we pay, we've paid and repeatedly a heavy price for battles. And we would like to think that there is some thought, some way, some process, some form of communication that would elevate us all, although the risk may always be there, will help us to find a better, an alternate solution. You have just too much on the go today to cram into one story. Masonry, you are, ladies and gentlemen, you are the story. You are the art. Hopefully that you've been inspired to read broadly in order to plunge the depths to unpack the deeper meanings for you. It's not about the deeper meanings of masonry for masonry. That's complicated and nuanced. But it's your story, your life, a life worth living. And so we need to be able to contribute by examining that. And how possibly could we manage to do that? Well, the message of Freemasonry, do you want to know the secret? Yeah, I'm sorry, the conspiracy theorists that may happen to hear this are going to be tremendously disappointed. It's simply to be a little bit better tomorrow than I am today. Just a little bit. Just that little bit. And the day after that, and the day after that, and the day after that. Not ruthless, not too extreme, not out of control emotion, not exaggerating, but just slightly a little bit better. That process of refinement we apply to us. And this is the way we do it. It's a mindset. Keep that thought in mind here. And just to suck in some of that oxygen that we need. We're going to plunge on here to the commentary. I'll just jump right into it. This is a reflection of the masonry as the quiet exchange. Do you need to run and top up whatever you're sipping on there? The crossroads. The fork asking the question we must all answer. By omission or default, it doesn't matter. What matters is what we reveal about ourselves. One road is so crowded, bussing along with clouds of dust from foot traffic, grim-faced and burdened with the weight of impatience, perhaps fearful of a realization of life. Their life is impermanent, acting as if life sentences us to an ultimate misfortune. Convinced we are all brought into this world, not of this world. No neutrinos passing through them, by God. Not a molecule of stardust to be found in their awareness. If it can't be seen, it doesn't exist. Though 99% of a molecule is empty, though we cannot come to terms with time, we are, in a sense, slaves to it. Slaves, eh? Rushing ahead, pretending it could be cheated by illusion. Meaning. Nothing matters but this moment. Imagination, for children. Science is the dominant occupation over art. Einstein was wrong to believe God is evident in the order of nature and the universe that we barely understand. 1,000 years ago, mathematics was favored by to occupy and entertain. 1,000 years ago. Today, he uses it to distinguish between himself as a have versus the 99% have-nots. Along the other path is the true Mason, he who knows there is more to life than conflict and hubris, who finds peace in the company of friends, who finds beauty in the sparkle of an eye, a cloudburst, a sunset. Inspired by the knowledge that an aggressor damages his own soul, the path less traveled can be a lonely trail. It is where a man can contemplate his purpose for being, where he finds the simple tasks bring happiness, and he hears a sound on that path, music that fills his heart and mind with notions of what could be. Do you care to join him? Join us. You may not have heard this. This is a Japanese pianist, Hiromi. Jazz fans in the room? Yeah, it's Pachelbel's Canon. Thank you. Cut that off. I'm sorry. I know it went on longer, but you know, jazz, it's like classical piece. I hope you enjoyed it as much as the performer did. She's just quite amazing to watch. Total performer. Hope that puts you in a complete frame of mind. And take this just a second here to thank our listeners. Particularly those tuning in from India and Russia, it's consistently amazing, and I'm happily ready to and able to acknowledge the audiences flowing around the world. And nod to you, our homeboys here in Canada, thank you, and in the United States and Britain. That's sort of makes me feel like we're serving purpose here with so many listeners from all over the world. The need you to probably be thinking about purpose and meaning and the flow and the engagement of masonry and to invigorate and inspire a bit. So to do that today, I want to I want to bring forward a few ideas, and I want to ask you a couple of questions. Is it feasible or reasonable for a true Mason to question? And I put that to you, to question sacred cows. is it a matter of the dogma, or is this about a process of imagination? This is a process of imagination. I'm one of those people that think that, you know, in my reading, that the Royal Society had much to do with the development or the gravitas, the magnetism, the orbit of the Masonic order. But it was happening at a time when orders and men's clubs were quite popular with a certain social strata, not for everybody in Britain, but the strata that we learn about in our history. We're not so ready to jump into the history of the poorhouses or the life on the street or the orphanages. We don't want to get into that, and we certainly don't want to look at the status and rights of women in those societies. We certainly do not. That would be wrong-minded to have a more balanced and fulfilled sense of history, wouldn't it? Or the displacements, the world where rights were not present. So there was a time, if we're going to be truly nostalgic, we can just pretend that everything before was better than it is today. As long as we can stay away from the stench of our own reality. Einstein told us, and, you know, he's being widely criticized. It's easier to criticize the dead than the living, I think. But of course, why wouldn't we want to criticize a genius? He was just a Jewish gentleman who made a significant contribution through physics and to the world. He said, if we listen to a genius, maybe we can stumble on something that makes sense to us. He said, imagination is more important than knowledge. And I began to think about that a bit. And if you think about it, knowledge is what's written about the past. Eh? Knowledge, it's what's written down. It's what we have accumulated, it's cataloged. The imagination is about what we can do with that knowledge, where we're going. Where can we go that doesn't have footsteps in the snow? There's a field out there, and we can go in different directions. Imagination, he says. He says, life is like riding a bicycle. I always like that. And he said, the reason for that is to keep your balance. You must keep moving. And the last little ointment that I'll leave you with from Mr. Einstein, from Professor Einstein, try not to become a man of success, but rather try to become a man of value. And to that, I would add a person of value. Today, I wrestle with that. How can I live in a world and espouse a sense of equality when I see the subjection of people around me in religious terms, in terms of gender, sexual preference? I'm trying to reconcile it, and I just have a very difficult time putting my head back in the sand and pretending. So if we're going to move forward with, as we always do, we have to keep moving forward. So that's a perpetual motion. And you and I are the newness. You and I are the innovation. All of our accumulated history and experience and knowledge, it all comes together each time we're initiating somebody into the craft. Now, could we have seen the current social struggles coming? Well, yeah, if we had been had the opportunity to sit down and think it through, could we have seen the rebalancing of racial connections? Can we see, in a sense, if we know you're a good historian, as many of you will know, there were have been cultures before us where there were blends of people of different races and different faiths and different ideologies, and they, by what measure of success, they were successful. They existed and thrived, and they left a legacy. I don't know how much of a legacy that we need other than the footnote that battles continued. I don't think that's exactly what we would say is a legacy, a step up for the next generation. It's perpetuating the past. I don't know if that's a mix of nostalgia, but I don't quite understand how we can we separate out hatred from nostalgia. Well, the lessons for that I see when old soldiers from different oppressors or opponents, the enemy, shake hands and have a cup of coffee and reminisce together in the common purpose. They lost friends, we lost friends. We lived in fear, they lived in fear. It's an interesting way of thinking. So to echo that, I want to talk to you about a massacre. It's sort of warish like. This one happened in St. Peter's Field in Manchester, England, on the 16th of August in 1819. I think my mouth is a bit dyslexic sometimes. This is when a cavalry charged into a crowd of somewhere between 60 and 80,000 people who had gathered to demand the reform of parliamentary representation. The end of the Napoleonic Wars in 1815 resulted in periods of famine and chronic unemployment, exacerbated by the introduction of the first of the Corn Laws. We'll come back to that another time. But by the beginning of 1819, the pressure generated by poor economic conditions, coupled with the relative lack of suffrage in northern England, had enhanced the appeal of political radicalism. And in response, the Manchester Patriotic Union, a group agitating for parliamentary reform, organized a demonstration to be addressed by an orator who's very famous in his day, Henry Hunt. But shortly after the meeting began, local magistrates called on the military authorities to arrest Hunt and several others and to disperse the crowd. So, and let this be a caution, cavalry charged into the crowd with sabers drawn. And in the ensuing confusion, 15 people were killed and 400 to 700 were injured. The massacre was given the name Peterloo, in an ironic comparison to the Battle of Waterloo, which had taken place just 4 years earlier. Robert Poole was an historian, and he's called the Peterloo Massacre one of the defining moments of its age. In its own time, the London and national papers shared the horror felt in the Manchester region. But Peterloo's immediate effect was to cause the government to crack down on reform. With the passing of that known as Six Acts, it led directly to the foundation of the Manchester Guardian, now the Guardian, and had little other effect on the pace of reform. In a study conducted by the Guardian in 2006, Peterloo came second to the Putney debates as the event from radical British history that most deserved a proper monument or a memorial. Peterloo is commemorated by a plaque close to the site, a replacement of an earlier one that had been criticized for being inadequate, as it did not reflect the scale of the massacre. The things men do under orders. So, remember that about that time, 1819, voting was restricted to male adult owners of freehold land, with an adult rental value of 40 shillings or more, That's the equivalent of about 80 pounds in 2008 currency. So suffrage, we probably need to pay attention. We probably need to pay careful attention to what's going on. And it's not a simple matter of being a centrist or a liberal or conservative. This is complicated. This is about a common history that's out of time. So I want to share with you, why is that? Why would I ever bring that up? Hey, why? Well, I want to bring forward a poem by John Keats to Autumn, and I want to This is when Keats was writing a lot of his work, and this interesting stuff for Freemasonry about John Keats' work is that he was just really tremendously enriched by his sense of mythology. Tremendous. So here's his poem. This is just three stanzas. This is an ode to autumn. Seasons of mist and mellow fruitfulness. And as you hear this, you reflect, what is it that he's stumbling upon? Is this about the, you know, he's getting at something here, but we're not really sure. It's not really pronounced. It's left for us to think it through. Is this about creation? Is it? Well, it's perhaps that plus. Seasons of mist and mellow fruitfulness. Close bosom friend of the maturing sun, conspiring with him now to load and bless with fruits of the vine that round the thatch eaves run. To bend with apples the mossed cottage trees and fill all fruit with ripeness to the core. To swell the gourd and plump the hazel shells with a sweet kernel. To set budding more and still more late flowers for the bees until they think warm days will never cease. For summer has overbrimmed their clammy cells. Who hath not seen these oft amid thy store? Sometimes whoever seeks abroad may find thee sitting careless on a granary floor. Thy hair soft lifted by the winnowing wind, or on a half-reaped furrow sound asleep, drowse with the fume of poppies while thy hook spares the next swath and all its twined flowers, and sometimes, like a gleaner, thou dost keep steady thy laden head across a brook. Where are the songs of spring? Ah, where are they? Think not of them. Thou hast thy music, too. Redbreast whistles with a garden croft, and gathering swallows twitter in the skies. So, is it about labor? Is it a metaphor for one who conspires, who ripens fruit, who harvests, who makes music? Or is it about the harvester? Worth a look. Again, step by step, moment by moment, just a little bit. What is it that makes you a little bit better tomorrow than you are today? What is that? This is Tomas Dankovas. Some music. Yeah. Thank you. Beautiful work. Beautiful work. German trumpeter.
Nice.
History's been kind to Masons, I think we can say. I think we can. It's esoteric. It's not probably ever going to be seen on a reading list for most schools. Some scholars pick it up. Just as you know, the scholars will pick up on the significance of events like the massacre we just spoke about. These things have significance if we are looking for significance. If we are looking for indifference, that what happened yesterday has no bearing on us today, so what I'm doing, if I become so consumed by my own worldview that I forget that I share it with everybody else, then that's the breeding ground for despotism. It's reckless. It's ruthless. It's rash. And we're seeing that played out around us in the 21st century. The players will become small footnotes, but the events will become hallmarks. They'll underline things that we knew. They'll bring forward the wisdom of the past. As we are part of a Masonic order, one of the perspective is quite interesting. We come in and we should, and I think, read the material that connects with us. It feeds that appetite. Generally, it's to learn more because we have this great gap between our root, our core operation, and us. And to be made part of something that is international is, for many of us, quite startling. The something is a process of that's really hard to put your finger on because it's more philosophical, it's more social, it's more a principle, it's a world of ethics, and it pronounces them, and it has warts and scars from its past that we, as we become more confident, are able to acknowledge and address. It's not an order for fools. It blossoms when imagination is applied to it, when curiosity is unbounded, when your appetite for knowledge drives you forward in those private moments. This is when many, many fellows, many people become self-directed learners. So today, self-directed learners out there, put your head up and look around. And what do we see? We see things that are times are changing, as Woody would tell us. But what impact will that have? Well, we've been part of change for a long, long time. And to reflect historically as if it's been quite benign, that we haven't changed, there hasn't been a dynamic, I think is a disservice and a discredit to the vitality of Masonry in the past and the composition. I don't think if we look molecularly at it, this order has appealed to very interesting, very bright people, and it still does. And it, part of the development, it does echo a political, geopolitical, cultural effect. Always the principles and the ethics rise above all of that. But the form that it's taken in different continents and in different jurisdictions certainly do echo the uniqueness of the history of those areas. So we never had a consensus, in a sense, beyond the consensus of the appeal of the ethic and principle of the order. The highest orbit within Masonry that galvanizes the function of Masonry is our philosophical contributors. And does that change? Well, our perspective on it should be changing, and I would think it does. And is innovation and the new tools available to us likely to change the way we go about our business? Well, hopefully. But there are some things that are irrefutable. We might be able to now. Someone like me would say, well, I like a hard copy book. I need to read that in front of me. But I could sit here at a screen and read the same thing. If I never grew up in an atmosphere of books, would that have the same meaning for me? Absolutely. No, probably not, eh? It's like me needing to unfold a newspaper every morning or read the weekly Guardian. Is that important? Well, and, you know, how do we transfer information? Well, personally, we just add to it, don't we? We pick and choose. Would I give up the kind of the many advantages of our time because it was so-called modern? Well, no, not likely. Not likely, not if it's my wife in a hospital and we have new techniques or new medication that's going to relieve some pain and discomfort. Of course not. But this happens to be an aspect of Masonry that embraces the arts and sciences. You know, there's no struggle within the confines of our of the form of the rituals and constitution of our order. Is the safety. It relieves the tension. Is science good or bad? Is a non-issue within Masonry. It is what it is. But for us now, we are expected to begin to ask the question without necessarily having a quick answer. What is this? You know, science is hard and factual, and the arts is not. And they're separate spheres, and how dare you suggest that that we're better for understanding the synchronicity of arts and science, and we're to study them. Rather audacious of our ancients, rather audacious. This has been kind of an interesting day. It's an interesting program. How to infuse that sense of nostalgia and recognition and admiration for a profound contribution to what I have today. Whether those fellows were just all just wanting to be somewhere else, I would think you'd have to be irrational not to. You would all want to be somewhere else, and we would all want the negotiators to find peace. So on those battlefields, for all those folks that were doing, took a deep breath and did what they had to do because they didn't have many options. A silent thanks, a silent nod, an acknowledgement. I think you did the right thing, even though, and you'll be long remembered. When all of the unsung heroes don't get medals and don't get acknowledgements or pats on the shoulder, or get to march in the parade, to all of those people who have contributed and sacrificed. Thanks. And back in the day, I want to take us back just a little while to the music of Edith Piaf, and this is done by a contemporary French jazz singer, Zaz. You've heard her on the program before. She sings with the same kind of verve, the same kind of confidence that Piaf brought to the world here. Thanks for tuning in, world, and I look forward to having you join us again soon on the Masonic Effects. This is a song about a young girl. Dad's a drunk. Too many children at home. She's sick. Doesn't have many prospects. Then her dad puts her out on the street to work. Life goes on.
enthusiasm.